You are listening to a podcast from WSUM. Catch UC Exceptional live on Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on WSUM 91.7 FM Madison.
Hello, Madison, and welcome to UC Exceptional, an interview show that you are currently listening to on WSUM 91.7 FM Madison. Each week on this show, we will have a guest on to get to know them and their story. I'm your host, Oliver Gearhars. This is my co-host,
Jeb Blossom.
And today our guest is
Yoshiko Herrera.
So before I get started, I want to say that this is kind of a very special episode because Professor Herrera is actually me and Jeb's professor. And, you know, we've been enrolled in Political Science 344, The Russian War on Ukraine, Causes and Consequences this semester, and have coordinated the scheduling for basically every episode of this show before or after lecture. But because of the topics that are probably going to be covered in this episode, I think it's pretty important to say that the opinions expressed on this show do not reflect the views of WSUM, the University of Wisconsin-Madison, or its Board of Regents. Now, where are you from?
I'm from Los Angeles, from the San Fernando Valley.
How did you make your way to Madison from over there?
I grew up in San Fernando Valley, and then I went to college at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. So I sort of moved across the country. From there, I went to University of Chicago. But an important factor is that I graduated in 1992, and also I did a study abroad. I did two study abroad trips in 1990, which turns out to be an important year in terms of European and Soviet history, because I was actually just on a French language study abroad in the spring of 1990. But before that trip started, I traveled around Europe with a friend, and we went to East Berlin and Prague and Budapest in January 1990. So the Berlin Wall fell in November 1989. So it was just a little while after the Berlin Wall fell. And it was a just kind of exciting time in Eastern Europe. So that sparked my interest in what was happening in Eastern Europe, what was communism, things like that. That was in 1990. And then Soviet Union fell apart in 1991. So when I was graduating, there was just, you know, a lot of things going on related to Russia, Soviet Union, et cetera. So that made me decide to go to graduate school and focus on Russia. And for that, I went to University of Chicago. So I went to University of Chicago starting in the fall of 1992. And then at that time, it was kind of opening up in terms of being able to go to Russia and different parts of the former Soviet Union. So I went to Russia in 1993 in the summer, 1994 in the summer, and then starting in 1995 in the summer, I went to Russia and I lived there for 2.5 years until the end of 1997. So that was also kind of an exciting, interesting time. Then I came back because I had a job interview at Harvard. I only had two job interviews. Well, I know, I only applied to two places. I only had one interview. My one and only interview was at Harvard.
What was the other place you applied?
I applied to my alma mater, Dartmouth College, but they were completely uninterested in me because I wasn't done with my dissertation, and I didn't have any publications. I was very early, but I had a good idea, and so I came back. I applied to Harvard. I got this job interview. I got the job, and then I had a year to finish my dissertation, so I did that in Chicago, and then I started at Harvard in 1999. And then I was there until 2007. Wisconsin had a lot of vacancies, and I ended up getting a job offer here in 2006, and I moved here in 2007. And then I've been here since then.
Wow. So one of the things that you mentioned, that was, so did you have a different focus during undergrad?
Yeah, I was going to be a chemistry major, but I had taken AP chemistry, and so I was exempt from various science classes my first year. And I got this advice, which maybe was, I don't know, good advice for political science, not good advice for being a chemistry major, which was to take non-science classes my first year to get these different requirements out of the way and to take organic chemistry the second year. But I took a political science class on communism and world communism. It was called World Communism. And I was just so, that was before I went to Europe, but I had just by chance taking this class on world communism just to fill a requirement. But it was a very interesting class, different things happening. So then I never went back to sciences. Even though I still kind of liked it, I just got interested in politics, and I just switched to that.
So you got snagged on the Gen Ed.
Yep.
So do you think that the class World Communism would be taught differently today?
Yeah, I mean, it was taught by this guy who was a very, very old guy who had seen a lot of different things in the 60s and 70s. And I mean, I still remember some things in the class because the college had a very high-level Russian language program. In fact, Joseph Brodsky, who's a famous Russian writer, poet, was the graduation speaker at my graduation. And there was a exchange program of students would go to Leningrad or Moscow. So in that class were a lot of people who had been in the Soviet Union. I was like, wow, these people, like, that's really interesting stuff. But you had to write a paper in the class, and the professor said, like, yeah, you know, every year I teach this class, this is in the winter of 1989, so like January through March 1989. And he said, every year somebody wants to write a class on the reunification of Germany, but finally people have accepted Germany's never going to reunify. It's done. No one has asked to write a paper on that topic this year. So that's, you know, winter 1989. And then, of course, Germany's going to reunify, like, the next year. The Berlin Wall is going to fall that same year. So, yeah, the class would be taught very, very differently. But it was comparative. It was classes on, there was people working on China, on, like, Czech, at that time, Czechoslovakia, Soviet Union, like, so there was a lot of different things going on. And one of the focuses, actually, of the class was on law, on, like, law in the Soviet Union, which is surprisingly still relevant now, actually. We have somebody at UW-Madison, Catherine Henley, who works on law in Russia. And so actually some of the things that we learned way back then are actually still kind of relevant, but some things, you know, are different.
So one thing you mentioned is that you went to the University of Chicago. I'm from Chicago. Did you enjoy it there?
Oh, yeah. I actually loved every minute of graduate school. I literally... it was a very different experience because my undergraduate college was Dartmouth College at that time. It was very sporty, very, you could say it was kind of right wing. By that, it meant like it was probably like divided 50-50, like Democrats and Republicans. And so there's like a big conservative movement on the campus and like very, very sporty and outdoors nature, not a very intellectual place. Although, you know, of course there were some smart and good people there, but University of Chicago is complete opposite of, like, no sports. Like, we tore down our football field and built a library. And, you know, we just sit around talking about Bourdieu and Gramsci and stuff like that. So it was a very different experience. But I liked the intellectual intensity of the place. I lived in Hyde Park. Everybody, so many people at University of Chicago were in that area, that kind of bubble of Hyde Park. And it was, you know, it was just a fun time. It was a different time. Like, you had classes at 7 o'clock at night. Like, a class could be from 7 until 9:30, and there was no attention to, like, family or, like, there was no married people as far as I knew. I mean, it just was a very intense student experience, but I enjoyed it at the time, and I liked living there. But I can't say I really knew that much about Chicago because I didn't have any money, so I couldn't, like, go to fancy restaurants or anything. I would go to, I mean, it's very old now, but we spent a lot of time hunting down used CDs at the time. And people still made mixtapes, like cassette tapes. Like, you would look for CDs all over the city, some discounted price, and then people would make these mixtapes. So I knew a lot of CD stores in Chicago, but that was most of my experience in downtown and the north side.
I know that since I've come here, I've missed the pizza pretty badly. Is that a shared opinion?
Well, I like this place, Pizza Bruta, here. And I don't know. I mean, as I say, like, I really didn't have very much money when I was a graduate student in Chicago, so I wouldn't say this was, like, the best culinary time of my life. And Hyde Park has changed a lot since the 90s, and if you go there, like, there were very few restaurants and bars, like a handful, and that's completely different now. So I don't know. That's like the food wasn't like a necessarily high, even though I know Chicago is like a very important city for food. Like at that time in my life, that wasn't like a great focus for me.
So where is that pizza place you like? Because I'm trying to find one still after a year here.
Oh, Pizza Bruta? Yeah. It's on Monroe Street.
Monroe Street. Okay.
Yeah. Pizza Bruta on Monroe Street, I think, is very, very high quality. It's Napoli-style pizza.
Oh, okay.
High-level ingredients.
All right. So now to move on to more of a professional question. So do you think that your experience has been... Do you think that your expertise has been called on more recently since the Russian invasion started?
Yes, since 2022, for sure. I gave more talks in 2022 in 1 year than I gave in like 20 plus years in academia. So for sure, like much more interest. But sadly, I think the interest has kind of dropped off in the last 9 months or so. Like, so I think the first year and a half of the war was a lot of interest, and then it's kind of dropped off. I mean, it might ramp up a bit more as things change, but I think as the war looked like it was turning into more of a stalemate and there wasn't a lot of movement on the front, then I think external interest kind of waned a bit.
So what was it like being an expert in a field that was suddenly thrust into a very high degree of relevance?
Well, on the one hand, because it's such a important thing that's happening, and it's such a tragic and destructive war. On the one hand, I was glad that people were interested. That because you don't want like something really bad happens, and you don't want people to say like, well, you know, I don't care. So yeah. You want people to care. On the other hand, it takes up a lot of time, and I had to learn different skills like. I now have more respect for people on TV because you have to look at this camera and you can't. I don't look at former interviews of me on TV.
I happened to see one of those last night.
Well,
I kind of know what you're talking
I'm
about.
I'm like looking like, I don't know. You don't really have a mirror. Like when you're talking to people in general, most people do not, record themselves and then say, like, where are my eyes focused? Or when you're in a conversation with a person, you will look at them. But on TV, you have to look at this green light, and you can't look here and there, do different things. So, I could see that as a skill. You have to learn to be brief. So you have to learn different skills. You have radio interviews. Sometimes, if it's a short one, like they're going to ask you a question for 1 minute, you have to be on point and things like that. So it's different skills. So, I had to learn some new things. But I was grateful for the opportunity to talk about the war, and I was glad that people were interested. So even though it took a lot of time, I never minded doing that. And I always said yes to people, even sometimes I would get a request from like some small town like library or something that wanted to do something over Zoom or something. Like I would do it. Or a small radio station in Texas or something. I would just say yes just to, or like different international venues. Although I tried to filter out the Russian RT ones. So I would generally be inclined to talk about the war because I thought it was an important topic.
One thing you mentioned is brevity. So did you ever feel disappointed that you couldn't go further in depth in the time you had?
Yeah, I think this is always, maybe this is like a general facet of academics talking to media. Like we always have this, oh, it's very complicated, let me tell you all the different parts of that. And often they don't, the host might be interested, but they're like, we have 30 seconds or we have 15 seconds. So we just want you to say something in that amount of time. So yeah, sometimes that's hard. One thing that was really hard is UW-Madison they have like some people that help you with media appearances, and they record like a teaser or snippet for you. So they'll do a video recording and they'll say, okay, we're going to ask you questions for a minute and a half. But the thing is, if it's live, you just talk and that's the end of it. But this was like, well, we're going to record it and then see how it looks. And then So sometimes you could do it like 10 times.
Do they have you, do they like break it down for you?
Well, yeah, I mean, they would ask questions, but then it would be a standalone video, but then you review it and then you could do it again. And then you could think, oh, well, I could have sent something slightly different, so I'll do it again. So that is actually kind of tedious. When you know that you could record it and do it again, that in a way was like more nerve-wracking than just having a live interview.
I definitely get that. That's so, I don't like that, like, media training scary.
Yeah.
So do you feel that there's anything that you've learned about your own topic of expertise since the war started?
Yeah, I think that for one thing, a certain level of humility is necessary. I think when the war started, I've been open that I did not think, if you look at interviews I gave even right before the invasion, I just didn't think Russia would do it because I thought the Ukrainians would resist. I thought Russia would never win. I thought it was obvious they could never win. So I didn't think they would invade. Other people thought they would invade, but they thought Russia would win quickly, Ukrainians wouldn't resist. I thought that was completely ridiculous. So, I mean, I think I was right about the Ukrainian resistance, but wrong about the invasion. And that led me to a lot of thinking, why was I wrong about that? Like, what did I get wrong about Russia? Studying the country for so many decades, like, why did I get that wrong? And that's kind of extended to a lot of thinking of, like, what do we know now about Russia that we didn't know, or why did we not know things? What? And it's just led to a lot of rethinking. Even just yesterday, I was arguing with somebody on Twitter about expertise in the 90s. And yeah, there's a lot of ways you can think about things. And sometimes it was right, and sometimes you think, okay, I don't think a lot of experts on the region, on Russia or other places, recognize the threat that Russia posed, despite, in retrospect, there being warning signs. So I just think it's the whole war has caused a lot of people to rethink what they knew about Russia, about Ukraine, about Europe, about the Baltic states, about different places, and why we were right or wrong. Not just were you right or wrong, but like, why did you miss things, and what would be the reason that you missed something?
So a lot of like new challenges to old expectations, sort of.
Well, I think rethinking assumptions is another way to put it. Like rethinking, why did we not see that as a threat, or why did we take that as natural? That's okay. Like, they want to do that. That's fine. And now thinking, like, maybe that wasn't fine. Maybe we should have been more skeptical.
Are you surprised by the amount of support for Russia in the United States? That sort of, I feel like it's only grown since the invasion.
I don't know. I would say in the first year of the war, I ran into very little support for Russia. Like, hardly anybody. Even, you may recall, like, back when Ron DeSantis was still a candidate, he said something like, we can't give Ukraine a blank check. But then he was very criticized for that, and he had to step back and say, like, oh, I didn't mean I don't support them. Yeah. So actually, I think there was very few people like Tucker Carlson, Donald Trump, maybe to some extent Sean Hannity, but not even fully Sean Hannity, like a very small number of people that were pro-Putin, pro-Russia. I mean, you might recall Trump said it right at the outset of the invasion that something complimentary about Putin, like he's a genius or something. So there was only a handful of people, I think. And when I would give talks, even to community audiences, to different people, I never ran into people who said, yeah, I really like Putin, I like what Russia's doing. So I would say in the beginning, I think there was almost no support for Russia. And one reason is that it was such a black and white conflict. It was not like the Syrian war or like some wars which are very complicated to understand who's on what side, why, what are they fighting for, what's the reason. This was just like Russia rolled in the tanks, just like crossing international boundaries, like they're the aggressor. So I think it was very simple for people to say like, oh, why'd they do that? That's wrong. So I think initially there wasn't support for Russia. I think in the last 9 months, that's when we really have seen this support for Russia among some people. But even still, even among some people that I would say are Trump-supporting Republicans, they're very anti-Democrat, anti-Joe Biden policies, so critical of the Biden administration for various things, but still not exactly pro-Russia, like Ukraine made this mistake or the Biden administration made this mistake, but not exactly, you know, Russia's doing the right thing, yeah. We should support them. So I think there's some wavering of support for Ukraine. And there are a few people, some academics like Stephen Walt, John Mearsheimer, actually Jeffrey Sachs, like surprising to me, prominent academics who blame the entire war on NATO expansion and say, you know, the West is to blame. And they're sympathetic to Russia. That's kind of surprising to me, some of those people, because they are just blindly missing facts, which surprises me for academics. So, yeah, I think I'm surprised on some level of some of this growing support for Russia. But I also think it's somewhat moderated by, like, a confluence of criticism of the Biden administration, criticism of Ukraine, versus outright support for Putin or what Russia's doing.
So one thing that I saw in the news, I reported on it for a daily newscast here at the station. It was at some kind of campaign event, Trump said that he would like let Putin do whatever the hell he wanted with Lithuania should it come to that sort of thing. And I think that that has been one of my like that was like such a crazy moment for me, hearing that he would pursue that kind of isolationist policy for the United States. And I was wondering what you thought about that.
Yeah, he made those comments in the context of he has a narrative that Europe underpays for its security. And it's actually interesting for Trump. There's certain views he has and he sticks with them. So one is that America overpays for security of the rest of the world. And going back to the 80s, actually, he had a full page ad in the New York Times criticizing U.S. support for Japan, saying Japan is like free riding and getting U.S. security guarantees in East Asia and not, you know, paying enough. And that's in the context of like, you know, kind of trade conflicts with Japan over cars and stuff like that. So he has that view. Then he has this view that NATO members don't pay enough of their, quote, fair share, and that the U.S. overpays. This is debatable in different ways. It's especially debatable post-2022 when a lot of NATO members have ramped up their support. But he has this general view that other countries underpay. I mean, for the same reason, he's kind of isolationist on, if you recall back in 2016, he was against U.S. forces in Afghanistan, in Iraq, et cetera, because he thought, like, why should we pay for some other country's security? You know, it's not worth it. He's the one that negotiated with the Taliban the exit of American troops, which was then implemented by Biden to a lot of, you know, criticism. So the Trumpian view is like, we're overpaying for other people's security. We shouldn't do that. And so his comment was, he has like the kind of, like he always has these, there's a set kind of fake story, which is that somebody comes up to him and says, like, sir, something or other. And so this leader of a European country is going to come up to him and say, you know, we haven't paid our fair share. Now, will you protect us? And his answer to that was, no, if you haven't paid your fair share, then I'm going to tell Russia, do whatever the hell they want. So on the one hand, it's in that context. But on the other hand, you have to kind of take him at face value when he says things, because he is against NATO. He's absolutely consistent on that. He thinks NATO is not good for the U.S., NATO costs too much. He already, when he was president, threatened to move U.S. troops out of Germany, and he did do that. He moved them into Poland. because he was really complaining about Germany not paying enough, which he had some, that had some validity that Germany needed to pay more for its security and defense. But when he says, if Russia attacks, we're not going to defend countries that are attacked, that is not a crazy concept, that, or for him. Like, he means that. And as the commander-in-chief of U.S. troops, he can't take U.S. out of NATO without congressional Senate approval, but he can command U.S. troops not to fight. He can move troops around. So he has a lot of leeway in commanding U.S. troops. And if you've followed the Supreme Court case the other day, this last couple of days, apparently he personally, as long as it's an official act, can break criminal laws. I mean, he can really, he has a lot of leeway as president. We'll see, he may have even more leeway depending on the Supreme Court choice. So the threat to European countries, the threat to NATO in a Trump presidency cannot be discounted, cannot be taken lightly. And I think Europeans now understand, like, this is a huge, huge problem for us, because obviously if Trump were to, say, make a deal with Putin or agree on not reacting to some kind of Russian invasion somewhere like in Poland. I mean, Putin has been talking about Poland a lot lately. This presents a big problem.
So I'd like to take it back a little bit now. Just sort of, I kind of have one last like little question about what it was like sort of being a younger academic graduate, sort of fresh out of graduate school or still in graduate school. Do you think that, what was the earliest situation where you had to really apply what you'd studied, what you know, particularly in relevance to the time you lived in Russia?
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, I was actually on the younger side because I went directly from undergrad to grad school and directly from grad school to a job. And also, I had no experience. So I only TA'd one class. I never took a class as a TA. That's issue number one. I never was in a, I never had a TA because I only took classes in small settings with professors. So I didn't have experience as a TA, of having a TA. I TA'd one class in my time at University of Chicago. I gave one lecture. So when I started teaching in 1999, I think it's fair to say I was underprepared. Plus, at that time, now there's so many teaching resources on campus, and teaching is valued now. Now people care about student learning outcomes. They care about the student experience much more than they did in 1999. Then it was like, just do your research and like it'll work out for you. Like, just go into the classroom and do whatever. So I was just very unprepared, and but you know, I had to come up with classes. I had to. I mean, I was at Harvard, and students were very, very good. So that's very helpful. If you have smart students, it's much easier because actually they are self-motivated. They do a lot. You just give them small prompts, like do these readings. They do the readings. They come to class prepared. So it's much easier to teach with students that are really motivated, engaged, and capable than students that are not. And so it's like much easier to teach an honors seminar, for example, than a required large introductory class, because you just, you know, you're dealing with different people. So I had to, I had to come up with syllabi. I had to come up with different kinds of assignments and things like that. And at that time, that was a very hopeful time, though, 1999. Even though there were some problems, the initial classes I taught were on things called like democratization and economic reform, because people thought, oh, that's what's happening in the world. Countries are democratizing. Economic reforms are happening. Like, everything is going in this positive direction. And so that's the way we were thinking about things. We weren't thinking about teaching classes on authoritarianism in 1999 or on decay or retreat from democracy or things like that. That wasn't how we were thinking about things. So, so we had to, you know, you have general ideas about the world and you come up with topics for classes that you think work. We had classes then, regional classes on post-communism because, you know, communism was ending. We expected that in China too, even though it's persisted. So there was, you know, different kinds of challenges.
So I'm pretty sure that you said that this was the case, but you did make the class that we're in right now, right? Or am I incorrect?
Did I come up with it?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, the class, this class was a direct effect of the war, of and also what I was talking about earlier about rethinking, about thinking how to, like, what to do. You know, you have this war going on, like, what to do? And I thought there was a lot of student interest, there was a lot of community interest, and it would be a good way to engage student interest in current events and to, you know, talk about something I knew about.
So what was it like creating a course that is so contemporary? Mm. Is this the first semester you've taught this course?
This is the second.
Second.
Okay, well, there's different challenges for talking about a contemporary topic. One is that things change. So you can't say prepare a lot of lectures and then say, like, oh, next year I'll just say the exact same thing I said this year, because that's the first thing, is that things change. Second is you have to have a concept of, like, how is this going to be an academic course? How is it not going to be just reading the newspaper or talking about current events? Like, what is going to be the way to structure it so people learn something? So the way that I structured it was, actually, I wrote an article about the class. I can send you if you're interested, in the Journal of Political Science Education, which was to say, and actually you could apply it to different classes. Like, I was just telling somebody that we should have a course, like, similar type of course on the Israel-Palestinian war in Gaza, where you have topics in comparative politics and IR, like democracy, identity, social movements, media, or nuclear weapons, bargaining, international institutions. You have these topics that we know things about theoretically and from other places. But then you combine it with the conflict at hand. So you talk about democracy in Russia or in Ukraine, or social movements in the two countries. So the structure of the class is that you have theoretical topics that there's political science work on, but then you apply them to the case at hand. So it connects the theoretical literature with a course, and it's not just what happened in the war this week, next week, et cetera, or it's not just the history of a war. It's taking those concepts and applying it. So I actually think it's a good idea for political science classes on a range of topics. Like, you could do similar things with other things of interest to people. I mean, not just war, like, could be on climate change, could be on different topics that you take theoretical work in political science and then apply it to that to make it more interesting to people.
I spoke with a friend who has a class in a similarly, like, sort of, I wouldn't say niche, but maybe, I guess, specific subject. Have you ever had, one thing that I noticed that he told me was that his professor included a lot of their own work and academic, writing. But I noticed that that's not really as much of a, that you haven't done that in this class. And I mean, I've seen you thanked in a lot of the things that we've read, but I've never seen anything directly written by you put in the class. Has that ever been a temptation or a choice?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I think that's, you know, that has pluses and minuses, right? Sometimes people are like, oh, yeah, I want to read what you wrote. But then it also makes students say, like, well, I'm not going to be critical of that, or I'm going to be reticent to say, like, you know, that's, like, I don't agree with that conclusion. So it could be pluses and minuses. But sometimes students are interested. So it just kind of depends. And it depends on also whether the particular expertise fits or not. So, I think it's sometimes it worked well, sometimes it doesn't. I mean, this class, because it's the only second time I've taught it, I changed the readings a lot. Actually, this year from last year, I'll probably change a few more things next year.
Are you teaching any other classes this semester?
Yeah, I'm teaching a class on ethnic and racial diversity, a graduate class. And I usually teach, well, typically we teach two classes a semester. Next year, I often teach this graduate comparative politics class in political science. And then I have an undergraduate honors introduction to comparative politics that I've been doing for the last few years. So I'm doing that in the fall.
So what are your, like, I guess, pros and cons, favorites, parts, least favorite parts of the classes that you do teach here?
Okay, I think obviously, or maybe not obviously, but definitely the best thing is interaction with students. Like, for sure, meeting people that are interested in a topic or, you know, I mean, as academics, like, we like to read things and discuss them. So, like, I actually love talking about politics all the time. So I'm never like, oh, that's my job, I don't want to do that. Like, anyone, I could be at a baseball game or a hockey game and somebody is like, oh, can I ask you something? I'm like, yes. So I love talking with students or anyone about different topics. So that's definitely the plus. The absolute worst thing that most people would agree on is grading. Like, nobody likes grading because, you know, people put a lot of effort into things. They do different things. And so grading is different from feedback. Like, if you read something and tell somebody what you think about it, okay, that's not bad. But assigning a grade, that is not fun. Multiple choice quizzes, no one likes them. Every student hates them. I assure you, it's also very tedious to write multiple choice questions. But it is also my experience that having a reading quiz incentivizes people to do the reading, and people's time is limited. It makes sense that they do things for which they have incentives to do them. So I think reading quizzes are necessary, but that is not a fun part of teaching.
No, I really like the way our class is laid out. I definitely think I'd struggle to get the readings done if there wasn't a quiz.
Yeah, I was going to say it.
But also it helps you retain it, because, like, I do the reading immediately, like, on a Sunday, and then at 1:20 I'm taking the quiz right away. And then I feel like I'm testing myself, got a better grasp on it.
Yeah, we actually changed it to have the quizzes be available a bit earlier in case people want to do the reading earlier, which, you know, totally makes sense. But it's very hard to make the questions not too obvious or easy, not too tedious or difficult. And actually, there's different kinds of questions that you would have if it's an open book or closed. Because if it's open, you can look something up. So you can say, like, what's the percentage of something, and, like, look it up. But that's not really a good question for an exam that's closed book, because, like, why should you have to memorize stuff like that? Quizzes, you know, they have their pluses and minuses. I used to have quizzes in class. I would have people take out a piece of paper, and I would have, you know, a question, and I would have them write it. But it's another level of torture to read everybody's handwriting. And then people hate that too. They would hate writing things out. So, you know, the multiple choice at home is like a kind of a compromise. But if you have ideas on how to improve it, I'm very interested because, we're always looking to improve.
Remember the first week it was a little rough, right?
Yes. Also, it is also difficult. Actually, this happened just last week, too, where we write a question. There's three of us. We look at it and say, like, yes, the answer is obvious. And then you see, oh, a bunch of people got that question wrong. Apparently, it wasn't obvious. I don't mind giving people points or regrading. I don't feel like, oh, it's like set in stone. If that was it, that's it. So sometimes we get things there's also expectations. Like, people don't know what to expect, how to do it. So if you do things over and over, you get used to it. Sometimes we just have in our mind what we think is easy, and then it turns out to be not so easy or not so clear.
So I know one thing that I noticed on your website was a partnership with a university in Kazakhstan. So can you tell me a little more about that?
Yeah. I worked on we had, I worked with this university in Kazakhstan called Nazarbayev University, and it's in Astana, the capital. Nazarbayev was the longtime president of Kazakhstan. He stepped down a few years ago. Kazakhstan is a, you know, partly free, not democratic, not a terrible autocracy, but not democratic, because there aren't really free and fair elections. But Kazakhstan had this interest in building a world-class university, and it's actually a very interesting thing. Instead of just having one university invest there, like NYU Abu Dhabi or something like that, or Yale in Singapore, like instead of like one university building another campus in another place, they wanted to build this big research university, and they would have different partners for different kinds of work. So like Duke was their partner for the business school, Pittsburgh was for medical school, and UW-Madison was the partner both for their School of Humanities and Social Sciences plus for the general administration. And I worked on that for like 8 years, and I was the head of our whole UW partnership, and there were hundreds of people on our campus that went to Kazakhstan, and people from Kazakhstan came here. And that was really interesting work because it wasn't just like two presidents of universities signing, you know, like documents. It was like somebody in our library who works on like cataloging will go to them and say, like, here's a different cataloging systems. Like, here's what you could do. Or like our registrar going to their registrar saying, like, here's the pluses and minuses of PeopleSoft, or like very detailed. Or like student activity, like peer advising, setting up student support groups or student organizations, or like addressing like parking for students on campus, or like we advised them on like all manner of administrative things, which was very interesting to see, like a university unfolding, like how to do things and like connecting. They had undergraduates come here as exchange students, so. It was actually very interesting, cool work. Unfortunately, there's kind of been a bit less support of the government for the kind of intellectual and political freedom on campus there in recent years. And the longtime president stepped down, and they're looking for a new president of that university, and so it's facing some serious challenges now. And the UW-Madison contract, I think, has come to an end. So it's not like in a great position right now. But the general concept of people, you know, putting a lot of effort and enthusiasm into trying to start a good university, that was a very, very, very fun and interesting thing to be part of.
So I think we're sort of nearing the end of our show, but is there anything in particular that you think more people should know about the Russian invasion?
Well, I think, you know, I know people are busy, they have different interests, but I do think we're actually in kind of a important time in world affairs. I mean, there's a lot of different conflicts that are really important. Israel war in Gaza, the Ukraine war, different things in different places. Like, there's actually a lot of conflicts in the world. And it sounds maybe like a slogan or something to say American leadership matters, or, you know, we need to be engaged. But American leadership absolutely does matter. This foreign aid bill that we just passed with bipartisan support in the Congress, supporting Ukraine, the Indo-Pacific, and both Israel and humanitarian aid in Gaza, it's really, really important to people. Ukraine could not, there's little chance that they could continue to defend themselves, let alone win the war, without U.S. military support. So I kind of just want to like appeal to people to say, it's not irrelevant what the U.S. does. The presidential election matters, Congress matters, our local races, even the Senate race in Wisconsin matter. These races do determine American policy, not just in the U.S., but like, I mean, there's lots of domestic issues like abortion, different things, taxes, like lots of things in America that matter, but also like there are really important global conflicts and U.S. leadership is vitally important. So I guess I just appeal to people to take a little time out to learn about what's happening and make informed choices when it comes to elections and being involved in politics.
One other question I had involvement. It slipped through the cracks. I didn't really, I like actually skimmed over it on my like interview doc. Do you have any news sources that you recommend people use to sort of keep up on what's going on in Ukraine?
Oh yeah. I listen to this podcast called Ukraine, the Latest. And it's run by these British guys that work for the Daily Telegraph in the UK. Dom Nichols, Francis Dernley, and some others that are very good. And I really recommend it because first they update like what's going on in the war every day. But then they have these other interviews with all kinds of people. It could be military people, it could be people working in volunteer capacities, it could be like musicians, it could be different kind of people. And I guess as an American, it's very, I don't know, they're very entertaining. Like they're giving you the news, but they're also, they come from different backgrounds. Like some are military, some political. So their team is diverse and very entertaining, but also very informative. I listen to it pretty much every day. So yeah, Ukraine, the Latest. I think it's a great resource. It's a podcast. Not everybody, you can watch it on YouTube also. That's one. I think any general newspapers, frankly, the Wisconsin State Journal has good international coverage. They don't cover every single thing, but if you read Wisconsin State Journal, I mean, that's actually a good news source. And then, you know, national newspapers like New York Times. Foreign Affairs has a lot these days that's very good. The Atlantic, The New Yorker, those are also, I think, really good sources. Some of those are behind paywalls, but Ukraine Latest is free, so recommend it.
Yeah, I just use a lot of, we've talked a bit about how people get their news in our class, and I just think it's interesting. I use Instagram for a lot of my news on the Ukraine conflict. Like there's these pages I follow where it's like they just talk about different conflicts around the world, and like the nitty-gritty, like there's Conflict Observer. Well, that's my favorite one, or Atlas News.
Yeah, I'm curious, do either of you follow, use Twitter or X?
Not recently.
Heavily.
Yeah, I just think this is an interesting generational differences. I might have to start, I have an Instagram account, but I don't do much with it. And I don't really use Facebook anymore, even though there's a lot of regional scholars that do a lot on Facebook. So yeah, I mean, those social media sources are also very good.
All right. Well, I think I want to say thanks for coming on. I really enjoyed just sort of sitting down and talking to one of my professors in a way that gets to go on the radio. So, yeah, I want to say I really do think that you seem exceptional. This is it's the thing I say. Yeah. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
All right. As a reminder, you can find all the old installments of this show at WSUM.org under the podcast tab. Goodbye for now, Madison. We'll be back at the same time next week.